please excuse us. I guess there's been a change of plans. I guess we're just going to go ahead and welcome our special guest that we have here this evening, Dr. Michael Ledeen. Please help me welcome him.
Thank you. It reminds me, some years ago, Henry Kissinger was supposed to speak to a large audience, rather like this one, and the person introducing him said, well, if ever there were a person about whom it truly could be said that he needs no introduction, it's Dr. Kissinger. So without any further ado, I give you Dr. Kissinger. No. And Kissinger sat there and said to him, no. I want a proper introduction, and I'm not speaking until you get back up there and give me a proper introduction. So I was tempted with this to do the same thing, but I don't have the same standing. Thank you very much for having me. It's a treat. As many of you probably do not know, Los Angeles is my hometown. I was born here at Good Samaritan Hospital a very long time ago. My father worked for Walt Disney, so there is no more pure Southern Californian than I. I went to Pomona College, and while it's true that I left here nearly 40 years ago, the bulk of my family still lives here, and so it's always a pleasure to come back and spend time with my many relatives and to make new friends and acquaintances and to meet so many people with whom I've only spoken on the telephone. Just imagine what you looked like. It's good to see your faces and so on. I want to start by trying to dispel a couple of illusions. Every Iranian that I meet immediately begins by thanking me for all the help that I and my colleagues at the American Enterprise Institute have been giving the people of Iran. But you must understand that we are not doing it out of a feeling of generosity and or even affection for the people of Iran. We are doing it because it is what America must do, and we are doing it for America. We are doing it for our interests. And it's important for you to understand this, because later on I'm going to talk about what it is necessary to do in Iran to succeed in what most Iranians want to happen to their country. And it's terribly important that everybody act to fulfill their own responsibilities and to enhance the standing of their own country and their own people. And when I first started writing about Iran, the first article I wrote about Iran, about contemporary Iran, happened when an Iranian friend of mine in Europe said, you're supposed to be a journalist. Why is nobody writing about what is going on inside Iran? And I said, what's going on? He said, look at all the demonstrations. Look at millions of people in the streets. Look at the people turning out and demanding an end to the regime. It's an enormous event. And so I started looking and on internet and making phone calls and so forth, and I found this enormous story. And the first article I wrote was, a potentially earth-shaking event is underway in Iran, and no one has noticed. And it's amazing that no one has noticed, because nothing more wonderful could happen to the United States of America than the fall of the regime in Tehran. And I want to remind you of that. Because I didn't write an article and say, look at the poor Iranian people, how they suffer. Look at the poor Iranian people, what misery they have been reduced to. Look at this terrible regime which has bankrupted the society and stolen from the Iranian people and impoverished them all. And the single word that everybody uses that I know who goes to Iran and comes back from Iran is degradation. That this once great culture has been reduced to degradation, physical degradation of the infrastructure, of the streets, of the highways, of the roads, of the buildings, and so forth, and the moral degradation of the people, of little girls reduced to prostituting themselves on the streets because there's no other way that they can make ends meet, and people taking drugs and drinking themselves into a stupor because they cannot bear to face the degradation of everyday life. That was not my point, although it's all true, and it's important. But that is not my point. My point was, and is, because I'm an American, and I've never been to Iran, I must tell you, nor do I have relatives in Iran. I have now an amazing number of friends in Iran. My point is that the United States is involved in a war against terrorism. We were attacked on the 11th of September, 2001. Everything we are doing in the world right now stems from that event. We are not acting out of a sense of philanthropy. We did not invade Iraq because we felt that the poor Iraqi people desperately needed liberation, although we are happy to liberate them. We acted because there is a series of regimes which sponsor terrorism aimed against the Western world and primarily against the United States. And the one thing you must never forget is that it is the attack on America that is driving all of this. And we are responding to an attack against ourselves. And the president has said over and over and over again that the United States does not distinguish between the terrorists and the countries that support terrorism. And that is why Saddam Hussein is gone. And it is why the regime in Tehran will be gone. And the regime in Syria will be gone. So that said, that clarified, I want to talk to you a bit about democratic revolution and how democratic revolutions happen, because I think there's enormous misunderstandings about how revolution takes place and what is necessary for it to take place. I spent many years working in the government, first in the Department of State, then in the Department of Defense, and then finally at the National Security Council, all during the last years of the Soviet Empire. And there was a relative small handful of people in those years who believed that it was possible to bring down the Soviet Empire. Most people did not think it was possible. Most people took the survival of the Soviet Union and the Soviet satellites and the Soviet Empire as something that was going to last all our lifetimes and probably well beyond. Many of us did not think so because we looked at it and saw that it was actually a monumental failure. And that if you look carefully at the Soviet Empire, you could see that it had only failed. It had failed from the beginning to the end. In fact, all it had ever done was fail. And that the Western world had been forced to save it several times in its history. And that had the West been serious about destroying the Soviet Empire, it could have done it almost any time since the middle of the 1920s. And we saved Stalin, and we saved Brezhnev, and we saved Gorbachev, and we saved them with detente, and we saved them with loans, and we saved them with grain credits, and all the rest of it. And then finally, we got a president, Ronald Reagan, who said, no, this is an evil empire, and it's time to bring it to an end. And he brought it to an end. And it happened so easily and so surprisingly and so quietly that to this day most people don't understand how that happened or why it happened, nor do they look at the 1980s and early 1990s in context and realize that we lived through what I called once the age of the second democratic revolution, because it wasn't just the Soviet Union that fell. Tyrannies fell all over the world. And it started in South America. Well, actually, it started in Spain when an unexpectedly peaceful transition from dictatorship under Franco to democracy under a constitutional monarchy led by King Juan Carlos took place. And it took place when everybody in the world believed that you couldn't get from dictatorship to democracy without violence, without some kind of terrible violent act, whether it was a civil war of the sort that the Spaniards had fought in the 1930s or whether it was a violent insurrection in the streets. And part of that, especially here in America, comes from the movies, because the movies distort our understanding of history, because you can't get a gradual, peaceful revolution in a movie. You can only get it in a book. It doesn't film well. It's not dramatic enough. And so most people think of revolutions the way Hollywood has filmed them, storming the Winter Palace, charging the Bastille, something like that, or that scene in The Godfather about the fall of the tyranny in Cuba. And yet the Soviet Union just vanished. It just dried up and died. The air went out of its balloon. It didn't explode. It wasn't violently overthrown. It imploded. It collapsed. And now if you look all over the world in those years, tyrannies collapsed and vanished peacefully from the world in country after country. When Ronald Reagan came to power, when he was elected president of the United States, there were only, I'm bad at numbers, but it's roughly this, there were only two elected governments in all of South America. When he left office, there were only two unelected governments in all of the area from the Rio Grande River to the South Pole, and those were Cuba and Suriname. Every other country in Central and South America had by then elected governments. And there were no great wars, and there were no massive acts of violence, no winter palaces were stormed, no bastilles were overthrown, no kings were decapitated, no prime ministers were hung from lampposts. It just happened. And then there was a pause, and now it's starting up again, the same process. And it's a bit more dramatic nowadays, but we've seen in recent years, for example, the fall of Milosevic in Yugoslavia. And while that was a bit more colorful and a bit more Hollywoody, if you like, there too, the people of the country simply turned out and said to their tyrant, "It's over. Be gone. Get out of here." And that government fell without violent civil war, without dramatic events. I mean, yes, there were some rallies, there were some strikes, there were protests, and all of that. But democratic revolution in this day and age can be accomplished and has been accomplished for the most part without terrible acts of violence, without enormous loss of blood, and all of that. The key event in the fall of dictatorship is something that you can't see, you can't measure, you can't quantify it, you can't see it on television, you can only smell it. And that is a loss of will, a failure of will on the part of the dictator. And you never know when that is going to happen. But I mean, in the case of the Soviet Union, it obviously happened when Gorbachev came to power. It was my favorite example. I mean, up until Gorbachev, every Soviet dictator believed himself to be the fulfillment of history's will. And as a person chosen by the dialectic to lead the Soviet Union to world domination. And one day, Mikhail Gorbachev looked in the mirror and saw not that, but a person trying very hard to keep his job. And that was the end. And then the Soviet people looked at him and they said, "It's over." And they started running out of Austria and protesting in Poland and carrying out a quiet revolution in Czechoslovakia, and bit by bit, the whole thing just fell apart, and it disintegrated, and it died. My guess is that is what is now going on inside Iran, because what I have written all these many months, and what everybody in the world knows, and the leaders of the regime tell you that. All you have to do is listen to them. I mean, they are the most reliable guides to what is going on inside Iran. What's going on is that these people are now terrified because they have expected all along, everybody knew it was going to happen. We were going to arrive in Iraq and Saddam was going to fall and we were then going to free that country and give it democracy so that people could make their own decisions and determine their own lives. And I have to say, there's a great thing happened the other day. Which a friend of mine pointed out. I had missed it entirely because she watches television and I don't. And she said there was a great thing on television from Iraq. First they showed the British in Basra. And the British had taken over Basra and they'd installed some old sheikh that they had hanging around for 50 years and put him in charge of Basra. And then they laid down a whole series of rules. And they said, okay, nobody can have weapons. Everybody has to be at home at this time and can't come out until that time. This is the person in charge of running this and that and the other thing. They just laid out a whole set of rules for the people. Then they showed the Marines in Baghdad. And I have to tell you that we're very partial to Marines in our family because our number one son is halfway to becoming a Marine officer. And so we get a lot of emails from Marines in Iraq. So we followed this war very closely. Anyway, so they were talking to a Marine who was walking through the streets of Baghdad, and people came up to him to talk to him, and they said, look, you know, what about guns? And the Marines in Baghdad decided that they didn't want big accumulations of weapons, so they said, nobody gets to have more than one gun. So if you want to have a gun and keep it at home, that's fine. That's what we do. We have guns at home in America. You can have a gun at home, but you can't have a lot of guns. One gun per person, that's enough. And they said, okay, one gun per person. And then they said, you know, we've turned in a lot of these terrible Ba'athists and so forth to you, and a lot of them have been arrested, but we see a lot of them back out on the streets. And they said to this particular Marine, so we're taking care of them ourselves. And the Marine said, that's fine, you take care of them yourselves. It's your country, you don't like them, you take care of them. You have to start doing that. And then another person came up and said, you know, there's been crime in our streets, so we're organizing groups in our streets to take care of it and so on. And the Marines said, that's what you should do. In other words, what's going on is that the Marines in Iraq, block by block and person by person and issue by issue, are saying to the Iraqis, this is your country. You assume responsibility for it. You are going to have to govern it yourselves. We believe that you are capable of making your own decisions and determining your own destiny. We are not going to stay here and rule you and tell you what to do. You are going to have to grow up and join the rest of the world and assume responsibility for your own country. We're going to be out of here as fast as we can get out of here. And we will. I mean, Marines don't want to live in Iraq. And General Garner does not wish to live in Baghdad long either. He wants to install a civil government, get things in an orderly fashion, and then the future of that country will be up to them. And you know better than I, there's long been in the Western world, and even in the United States, which is supposed to be immune to this kind of thinking, there's been a kind of racism directed toward Muslims in general, and Arabs in particular. There's a kind of belief out there that there is something somehow built into Islam that makes it impossible for people to govern themselves. And that Arabs, in any case, can never govern themselves because there's something in their DNA. There's some missing democratic chromosome, right, that makes them that they can't do it. And yet, if you look at the history of that part of the world, I mean, for a very long time, for most of modern history, Islam was the high point of the world, the highest level of culture, the highest level of civilization, the most tolerant of societies. I'm Jewish. Jewish people throughout the Middle Ages, if they had the chance, if they were able to choose between living in Catholic Europe or the Ottoman Empire, the Muslim world, they were much better off in the Muslim world, much better off, incomparably better off. And all of that talk about, Renaissance and Reformation. There never could have been a Renaissance without Muslim civilization, because all of the truth, all of the real documents of ancient Greece and ancient Rome, which was the basis for the European Renaissance, they were all preserved in Alexandria and Baghdad because they were all destroyed in Catholic Europe. So Americans who know that people from everywhere are capable of self-government because we've proved it, because this country is composed of people from everywhere. And we govern ourselves. So there's nothing genetic that prevents any given kind of person or any person with any set of religious beliefs from governing himself. It can be done. It's just a question of whether people are prepared to do it. So what we have said to the Iraqis, and what I say to you, and what we will say to you, is that Iranians are going to have to assume responsibility for their own destiny. And they cannot and must not look constantly outside Iran to other places and other peoples and say, we've made a terrible mess. Iran is in a terrible circumstance. Come and save us. That's not the way it's supposed to be. People are supposed to save themselves at a certain point. Countries make mistakes. Whole civilizations make mistakes. Sometimes they even make fatal mistakes. Civilizations have committed suicide. Whole nations are quite capable of committing suicide. It just happens. Most everything has happened in history at one time or another. But Iran has not. Iran has actually gone through a kind of vaccination process against tyranny. Because the Iranians convinced themselves in 1979 that they were staging a glorious revolution against tyranny. And then they discovered a few years later that they had made a terrible mistake. And that in thinking they were acting against tyranny, they had installed a tyranny even worse than the one they thought they were fighting against. And now, a generation later, everything we know about Iran, everything we know about the whole country, everybody in it, without exception, is that everyone agrees that the Islamic Republic is a failure. There's not one person in Iran, I mean, this is for sure, there's not one person in Iran who believes the Iranian Republic is a success. At the latest meeting of the National Security Council, the Interior Minister, the Information Minister, presented to Khamenei and the others a list of 1,600 failed problems in Iran and said, if we do not deal with these problems, the whole country is going to blow up. Now, I'm an historian. I mean, I've studied a lot of history. I don't know of another country in history where an interior minister or an information minister came to the king or to the tyrant or to the president and said, sir, we have failed in 1,600 ways, and if we don't deal with these things, we're finished. Now, those are the rulers of Iran. The people of Iran know it in detail because they are suffering the consequences of the 1,600. Right? This is a government where when they take their own public opinion polls, they come up with 71% of the population that hates them. And these polls, I mean, just think concretely, how are these polls conducted? You are a normal citizen of a major city in Tehran, Isfahan, Shiraz, you're walking down the street, some person comes up to you with a clipboard and says, hello, I'm from your Ministry of Information, and I would like to ask you a few questions about how you feel about our regime. And so you know this is a loyalty check. Even though the people knew perfectly well that it was a loyalty check, 71% of them said, this government stinks. We don't like it. We'd like to see it changed. And when a CIA polling organization called from Washington, so imagine you're sitting at home in Tehran and the phone rings and you say hello, and a voice says in a kind of funny accented Farsi, hello, I'm calling from a public opinion firm in Washington, D.C., and I would like to ask you a few questions about how you feel about your government. So there it is again. So you don't know if this call is really coming from Washington, D.C., but you know whatever it is, it's another loyalty check. And there they got 74 or 75% that didn't like it. So if you get these numbers in these circumstances, you know that the real numbers are much higher. All right? So what's the conclusion? What is the bottom line, as we say? There's 70 million people in Iran. So let's take the conservative figure. Let's say it's about 70%. People don't like it. So 50 million out of the 70 million people in Iran don't like the regime. Let's say on a bad day, you could get 10% of them to turn out in a demonstration against the regime. That's 5 million people. And that's 10% of 70%. And these are all conservative figures, because probably it's more like 80 or 85%, and probably it's more like 55 or 60 million. And probably you could get 25 or 30% of them to turn out on a given day. Right? Now, is there anyone in this room that does not believe that if you put 2 million people in Tehran, 1 million people in Isfahan, 500,000 people in Shiraz, and put them in the central squares of those towns and told them all to stop working and shut down the oil fields and shut down the textile industry and close the schools and block the roads and have those people say to the regime, okay, it's over. All we want, we don't want your neck, we don't want your blood, we just want you gone, that it wouldn't work? All right. So if that's true, as I believe it's true, and it doesn't require the United States Marines marching in across the border, and they're not going to march, believe me. There is not a person in Washington who has the slightest intention of ever giving an order to drop a single bomb on Iran or fire a single bullet into Iran. Nobody. Not the wildest hawk, not the most bloodthirsty neoconservative, as we are all called nowadays. No one, right? We will support the Iranian people. We will broadcast to the Iranian people. We will do all of that. We will do all of that. But this is all about, I mean, we have an amazing president right now in Washington. In many ways, he's the most amazing political leader I've seen in Washington, where I've been living now for 27 years. And we've had three of them, actually, just like him, more or less like him, since the end of the Second World War. And it's all the same, it's the same pattern over and over again. They are people who are not intellectuals, who are not cultured, who do not have experience, who have not traveled, who do not speak foreign languages, all of this, but who understand very well because they have a spontaneous bonding with the American people and they know how Americans feel and what Americans want, and they become the expression of that, and they have unerring instincts on foreign policy. And it's something almost magical. I don't know really how to explain it, but we've had three of them now: Harry Truman, Ronald Reagan, and George W. Bush. And it's the same phenomenon each time, and the world always reacts the same way toward these people. They say, well, you know, what a shame that such a great country has to have such an idiot for a president. And how can you take seriously a person who mispronounces words and makes up words, like strategery and things like that? I don't think that many people in the Middle East are laughing about the mispronunciation of strategery today, because he knows what he's about and he's serious about what he's doing, as were Reagan and Truman, right? And it's the same thing. So that somehow or other, President Bush understood immediately after September 11th that the war against terrorism was a war against tyranny, and that to defeat terrorism, democracy was the solution. And that, yes, here and there we were going to have to use military power. Not everywhere. Different countries called for different solutions. But that the end of the action, the way to win the war, was to spread the democratic revolution through all those countries which were supporting terrorism, because that is what they most fear. And he's very serious about this. And I would counsel you, because I've learned it myself at first hand, if you want to understand what's going on in Washington, don't watch the evening news, don't read the newspapers, just listen to what the president says. I can't begin to tell you how many times inside Washington has failed to anticipate what this administration was going to do, and they've always failed to understand it when they ignored what the president said. This president has been unbelievably consistent. And one can criticize him, and I do, for taking too long sometimes. I think we took much too long to get from Afghanistan to Iraq. All right. And I think if we had done it faster, we wouldn't have had many of the problems that we had. We would have had most of the world in favor instead of most of the world against. We would have not had the internal problems that we had. We would have kept the pot boiling in the region, which was important. But all right, he got there. And when it was all over, he said to the Iraqi people, he said, now you know that we mean what we say and that we're going to do what we say. And the Iranian leaders know that, too. So where are they now? I mean, imagine yourself to be Rafsanjani or Khamenei or whoever your favorite devil may be. And you're sitting there. You're sitting there and you have Afghanistan on one side and you have Iraq on the other. And you have in Iraq the greatest instrument for democracy of the 20th century, namely the United States Army. And you're scared. They're scared. I mean, look at how Rafsanjani is behaving. I mean, this tough guy, the guy who said that America is going into a quagmire in Iraq, that it's going to be Vietnam all over again, and that we will rue the day that we ever set foot in Iraq, and it's going to be a long, bloody war and so forth. Well, you know, if the French hadn't blackmailed the Turkish opposition parties, the war would have taken 2 weeks instead of 3 weeks. It took 3 weeks because we were unable to come down from the north as well, so we had to sail all the way around and do all these parachute landings and so forth. Very annoying. Okay, so it took 3 weeks. He sees that. They all see it. And so they see an irresistible power on the one hand. They see a freed Afghanistan on the other. They know democracy is coming to Iraq. Yes, they're going to do everything they can to stop it. They've put thousands of terrorists inside Iraq. Many of them are dead already. Others will die in the weeks ahead. Some of them will kill our people. And they are trying to repeat in Najaf and Karbala the same strategy that they used to bring down the Shah in 1979. It's exactly the same thing. They're trying to... Well, it is. I mean, it's wonderful. If you look at the pictures of these so-called spontaneous demonstrators, the Shiites carrying all these banners, very thoughtfully and considerately written, both in Arabic and in English. In Arabic for the people and in English for CNN and the other television networks. If you look at it, what really dazzles you is how beautifully clean these banners are and how wonderfully professional is the lettering. And you have to ask yourself, I mean, here's a country that was already in misery before the war, which has now been bombed and shelled and marched over and so forth. Somehow, someone very considerately saved miles of fabric on which to write these things, and then now all they have to do. Right, right. So it's obvious. And, you know, we're slow in Washington. It's true. I mean, democracy is a very messy, very sloppy, very slow process, maddeningly slow, and unbelievably messy. But we're not stupid, and we get there. And the nice thing about, I have to tell you, the nice thing about being a superpower is that you have a greater margin for error. So you can make mistakes, and you can take longer to get there, and you can still recover, because we have this enormous power of every sort. And what the tyrants never understand about the United States, it's the same mistake that every opponent we had in the 20th century made over and over and over again. And it's really astonishing that people have not figured it out. That is, they do not understand the unbelievable power that a free people has when it mobilizes together to solve a common problem and confront a common threat. And the Japanese and the Germans really believed that with Pearl Harbor, they would knock us out of the war and we would not be able to get back into it until it was too late. Just as Osama bin Laden and the whole network of terrorist countries believed that with September 11th, they would so frighten us and so shatter us and so break our nerve and our morale that they would be able to have their way first in the Middle East and then elsewhere. And they were totally wrong. Because the only thing they accomplished when they attacked the United States is not to make us afraid, but to make us angry. And it's dangerous to make the United States angry. Very dangerous. And there's a long list of people who you can ask about how dangerous it is to anger the United States. What the United States now sees, and even those who did not want to see it, who desperately did not want to see it, and there are many of those, always, now see Iran pouring into Iraq to do everything possible to prevent a free and democratic Iraq from coming into being. And they see it. We all see it. I mean, you cannot fail to see it. It's just, it's there. And yes, American intelligence, contrary to legend, isn't very good. Not very good. We haven't had people for years and years. If you've read my book, The War Against the Terror Masters, you will find that as of September 10th, 2001, we did not have, so far as I know, a single case officer in Iran, Iraq, or Lebanon. Not one, not a single one. And so it's very hard, given that, to have an appreciation of all the details and the subtleties going on in a country as complicated as Iran. And Iran is a wonderfully complicated country. Terrific to study. I mean, my field is not Middle East, but Italy. Italy is the country I know best. And I have a kind of spontaneous understanding of Iran because Iran is sort of Italy one step further. I mean, Italy is terrifically complicated and clever and baroque and imaginative and full of deceit and cunning and wonderful stories and fantasies. And Iran is even more so. But I mean, but it's the same model. You know, it's nothing to applaud. It's the nature of Mediterranean civilization, of which Iran is a part and of which Italy is a part. I mean, they have it's a common pattern. But when the United States really focuses down on an area of the world because our guys are there and they are at risk and we don't want anything to happen to them, we really do see everything that moves and we really do hear everybody who whispers. And we are now seeing everyone who moves and we are hearing everyone who whispers. And we know. So we see Iran doing this now. And Rafsanjani and Khamenei and all the rest of them know that. But they have to do it because they're desperate, because they know that their people hate them, because they know that their allies are also in line. They know that the terror network that they supported for so many years is now in grave jeopardy and that we are coming after them. And if Syria falls, then if Syria goes and Lebanon is freed, where will Hezbollah go to live? And where will the various Palestinian terrorist organizations train? I mean, they were training in Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq for the most part. Well, Iraq is gone. Syria is equally terrified along with Iran, and they are suddenly closing their borders and pretending to be law-abiding citizens. What will happen? So they must now fight us in Iraq. There's no escape for them because they're doomed and they might as well go for it right now. So they're going for it right now. Right, moral for you, for the Iranian people. Now is the time. Now is the moment at which this regime is at its most exposed, at its most vulnerable. Their self-confidence has been shattered. Every forecast they made about the way the war would go in Iraq has been proven false. Everything they said to themselves, above all to themselves, but also to the Iranian people, about the weakness of the United States, about the indecisiveness of the United States, about the inability of American soldiers to fight hand to hand and face to face, all of that has now been destroyed. And the Iranian people know it. So now is the time to fill those squares, to shut down the oil business, to shut down the textile companies, to close the schools, to close the universities, and to say to the regime, it's over. Go away. Get out of here. Now, if you've read my stuff, I have been pleading with the American government now for over a year to support democratic forces in Iran. And when I sit down and talk to them in Washington and say, why are we not doing this? Why are the Iranian people less worthy than the Filipinos or the Yugoslavs or the Poles and the Hungarians? Why are we not doing this? For the most part, the answer, they don't say it exactly in this way, the answer is we don't know exactly who to support. Who do we, I mean, suppose we gave you $10 million, who would you support? Because we don't see a leader, we don't see to whom we're supposed to give this. And it's a fair comment. And I know a lot of you say the same things to yourself. Well, and the answer is that this kind of comment comes from people who don't understand how democracy and how democratic revolution works. Because you never see them at this phase. You only see them once it gets going. And they are there. We know they're there. Because if they weren't there, these demonstrations wouldn't happen. If they weren't there, you couldn't have a million people in downtown Tehran demonstrating and hundreds of thousands of demonstrators starting at the university sometimes, but then spreading through the rest of the city. And people standing out in the streets and silent vigils and people flooding the streets carrying candles. So we know that it comes from someplace, and we know that the leaders are there. We do not know who they are. To which I say, and thank God we don't know who they are. Because if we knew who they are, the rulers would know who they are and they'd be dead. But we will find out who they are once we start to support them, because then they will emerge. In any case, the channels exist. We know what the organizations look like, at least enough of them to start the process moving. And we know what they need. They need, first and foremost, money. Because they need to go out in the streets, and to go out in the streets, they have to be able to say to their wives and children, here is money for a month. So if I'm arrested, here's food for a month, here's heat for a month, this will keep you going. They need instruments of communication, satellite telephones, and all the rest of the apparatus that, so that they can coordinate between one city and another. And they know how to use these things. I mean, all of us know how amazing the communication is from Iran to here, on internet, by phone cards, by cell phones, all kinds of different ways, and all the tricks that they have used now to cheat the regime, to stop people from finding out who they are and how they're calling and so forth. And this brings me to my final point, which is where I started about my own country and where I'm going to end with yours. And that is, help will come from the United States government, but it will come most quickly and most efficiently when the United States government sees plainly what is going on and a real thing for them to support. And that's for you to do. The Iranian diaspora is one of the richest diasporas in history. Few communities have ever left a country, gone overseas, turned themselves around, and enriched themselves, as have Iranians. Above all in the United States, in unbelievably wealthy communities in California, in Massachusetts, in New York, I discovered recently in Minnesota, something which I hadn't even known. Senator Coleman informed me about it. Right? Countless wealth. Even if there is no particular tradition of philanthropy in the Iranian diaspora, in the sense of sending money back home to support the people back home, surely there's enough business sense to realize that if you invest $10 million today in the future of Iran, you will get $10 billion back within a very few years. I mean, any person with a business head on his shoulders has to know that this is one of the best investments in the world today. Invest in the future of Iran. Support democratic forces in your home country. I mean, you can hardly do better than that, right? So as you contemplate the future of Iran, Think first about how to organize the Iranian community and the diaspora to raise the money that's needed for Iranians in Iran to stage the kind of democratic revolution that we all know can succeed and will succeed. And the only thing that's lacking is the wherewithal, a bit of money, not even a lot of money. And I wrote someplace that if the Iranian community in the Western world behaved the way the Jewish community in the Western world behaves, Iran would have been free 10 years ago. And you can free it any time. It's lying there, ready to be taken. It's begging you to take it back. And now you have a young country with a young generation of people who are actively studying democracy. That is what they are most passionately studying. That's another revelation to me. Because I talk to lots of people who go to Iran to teach in Iranian schools on exchange programs and so forth. These programs exist. And all of them come back and say, it's amazing. They're all studying the American Constitution. They're reading the great documents of American political thought. They're doing comparative constitutional studies. They're comparing the American Constitution with British common law, with the French Constitution, and so on. That's what they're doing. They're getting ready because they all know that it's coming. All right. So you must have faith in these people. You have to support these people. It has to come from you. You are the ones who owe them this. You are the ones who were driven out and came here hoping to find a better life, and you found a better life. To conserve it for yourselves here and not do anything to liberate this generation of Iranians is really a kind of betrayal, isn't it? You need to help them. And you need to do other things as well, at least for a while. Like all emigre communities, the Iranian emigre community is terribly divided. There are factions on everything. Right? There's parties within parties. There's sects within groups. Everybody wants to have the instrument for speaking to the Iranian people. Lots of different radio stations, a couple of different television stations. Each, you know, I talk to everybody. I refuse, it's not my game. I'm not going to play this game. So what I have always done is anybody who calls me up and says, I broadcast to Iran, I talk to them. I talk to everybody. And I hope you will forgive me when I say to you that every one of you that I have talked to has always said, I'm the real one, don't talk to those other people. Yeah? All right? Well, okay. Time for that particular game is also over. And it's time for you to forget that kind of competition because, I mean, suppose you win. Then what? Suppose you are the only one. And then? I mean, that's not what's at stake here. This is big-time game. We're talking about freedom for an entire country, 70 million people, and we're talking about the crucial blow in the war against terrorism. If we don't bring down Iran and this regime survives and they somehow manage to wiggle their way out of the situation in the Middle East, we will get another September 11th. Worse, much worse. And it'll keep happening over and over again until finally this thing is brought down. Because we all know that Iran is the mother of international terrorism. It's the greatest group. So please forget about internal competition. It's time for unity. It's time to get yourselves together. And it's time to get yourselves together here, and it is time then to have your representatives, some of them, come to Washington permanently and sit there and talk to the government. Government has to hear from you. It's not enough for them to hear from me. I don't have the same standing. You speak firsthand. You speak Farsi. I don't. You're on the phone to people in Iran every day. I'm not. I can't speak with the same authority that you can. You have to be there. You have to talk to the leaders of the executive branch and the leaders of the legislature. You have to sit on them. And you can't let these various senators, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, and they're on both sides, who somehow have gotten confused about what's going on in Iran. And you can't let the Deputy Secretary of State stand up and say Iran is a democracy and let him get away with it. All right? So you have to be there. So you have to unite yourselves here. You have to get yourselves an office in Washington. It doesn't have to be anything glorious or fancy. It's very hard work. It's very frustrating. You have to do it. And above all, you have to get among yourselves and you have to raise yourself several million dollars and get it to the people in Iran. And if you, I can't imagine, but if you're in any doubt as to how it should go or where it should go, call me up and I'll tell you where to send it. So you can send it. Right? I'm not, you know, I don't want it. I know who will use it best. And tell the people that you go to raise the money from, we don't need it all at once. I mean, probably the real number that's necessary to free Iran today, the top number, is probably $20 million. I think you can buy yourself a free Iran right now for $20 million. And you can say to the people to whom you go to get this money, don't give it to us all at once. You don't have to believe it all. Test it. Give us five and watch what happens. And if you're satisfied with what happens, then give us another five and another five and another five. So as long as the people inside see the first tranche, start to act, and know that as they succeed, more support will come to them, they will do it, and it will succeed. And then we will really be in a position to have a great party. The other night, you know, the American Enterprise Institute, all these years, has supported Ahmad Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress in the face of the most violent opposition from most of the world. And Ahmed called the other night and he said, okay, come to dinner in Baghdad. We're ready for you. And I said to him, no. I said, we're going to come for a week and we're going to spend the first half of the week in Baghdad and the second half of the week in Tehran. So you're going to have to wait a little bit longer. So that's my sermon. So thank you very much, and I'll be happy to answer your questions. Fine, just call me.
Sure.
We'd like to conclude this evening's presentation with questions and answers. So.